Coming up on This Week in Computer Hardware, a solid $59 CPU, 27 Thunderbolt drives on one machine, AMD's Radeon R9 295X2, NVIDIA's GeForce Experience 2.0, and AMD cards are dropping in price. All this and more coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 263, recorded April 10th, 2014. Gaming parts from $50 to $1,500. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch's weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, and most important news and advice in computer hardware, tablets, chips, processors, mayhem, and occasionally, ladies and gentlemen, basketball. Mr. Ryan Trout is in mourning, so we're not going to mention basketball for the rest of the show. I want to remind him that he does have a wonderful, wonderful handicap in golf, and he has many years to correct that. And, you know, how you feeling, man? You doing okay?
Okay. I'm good. It took a couple days to get over the loss of Kentucky to UConn, but we had a good trip. My wife and I went down to Dallas for that, and we had a lot of fun. Otherwise, I'll tell you what, I am glad that the team made it to the championship game, and that was Monday night. We actually left Tuesday morning, as opposed to losing the Saturday night game and then kind of being stuck there the whole weekend, like all of Saturday, all of Sunday, all of Monday before you leave on Tuesday. I don't know how that would have felt walking around, you know, the whole city with a bunch of people who are a lot more happy than you are. So this way, I was in a bad mood. We walked a mile back to the hotel, went to bed, woke up, got to the airport, and immediately flew away from the state of Texas. I probably don't want to visit Texas anymore for sporting events. I'm 0-2. So. That's
I'm sorry. That just sounds awful. On the upside, I mean, it's Texas. There's tequila, there's whiskey, there's barbecue.
Lots of good things.
There's if you're going to drown your sorrows, man, you can just drink yourself and heart attack your ass on brisket, but that may just be me. Scooter X just posted something really awesome in the chat room. Macworld Lab is testing for an upcoming Thunderbolt story. In this pick, all devices are connected to one Mac Pro. And Roman sent this out, who I used to work with a long time ago at Tech TV. Do you see all that? That's all apparently connected to that little tiny black cylinder in the middle.
That's pretty cool.
And I'm going to count really quick. So if all the monitors are connected by Thunderbolt, let's just say two of the monitors are connected by Thunderbolt. I'm guessing there's one, two... I don't know. You know, I can't even count this high at the moment.
So does that have four Thunderbolt ports on it, or does it only have two?
Well, part of the problem is I'm trying to figure out, some of these look like power supplies and some of these look like actual drives. Like, you know, and if you look across the bottom, there's like, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Hold on. Let me see if I get this. Cause okay. These are power bricks up there. Those are portable drives. Okay, hold on. I think I got it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27 drives or NAS boxes and four monitors.
Let's say one configurable monitor.
Well, you know, the thing that's got me is the math is so high now, I have to use a calculator, right? Because it's, if you figure it, $50 a Thunderbolt cable, that would be 27 times 50 equals, that's over $1,000. It's $1,350 in Thunderbolt cables.
Hey, fiber optic, not even fiber optic, that's all copper cabling. Yeah. Hey. If you got all those drives and devices and monitors to go with it, it can't be that bad. You gotta be doing all right.
I'm not saying, yeah, well, you know, but it's also like the entire, I guess, hardware, probably everything in the hardware bins at the magazine. AMD Radeon R9 295 X2 8GB graphics card review. 8 GB. 8. Yep. What in the world do we need? Is this going to be like a 4K GPU, solo GPU, or are we going to require two of these To run a 4K monitor, giving us 16 gigabytes of texture mapping glory.
Well, so remember, this is a dual GPU card, so it's 8 gigs, but you're still getting 4 per GPU. Okay.
First of all, but, Pat, let me explain to you that you can't do math.
Well, hey,
I'm mocking
myself. I would say that this card is really mostly built for 4K display. We do 4K benchmarking in our review of it for sure, and that's it makes 4K gaming feasible. It also helps it stand out a little bit more from the competing NVIDIA options as well, right? That's its performance advantage stretches a little bit when we go from, say, 2560 by 1440 to 3840 by 2160. I mean, this card in and of itself, even if you just look at it, it's a beast, right? It's two GPUs. Yeah. It's two full AMD Hawaii GPUs, 5,632 stream processors. If you do the math combining it, they're running at full speed, actually a little bit higher than reference speed of the 290X. You got 352 texture units, 128 ROPs. I mean, anything that one GPU had, you are essentially doubling it. GDDR5 memory, each GPU having access to the 4 gigs, as we talked about. It's a $1,500 video card. It has a 500-watt TDP, and it is water-cooled. So if you look at the photos of it, you can clearly tell that it's got a kind of like the self-contained closed-loop water cooling system that you're used to seeing with standard processors or processor coolers.
Right.
They're cooling the two GPUs on this graphics card. So you've got two Acetek pumps, heat, what am I thinking, water blocks and integrated pumps on them. They're operating in series. And then there's 120 millimeter radiator with, you know, all self-contained maintenance-free type design. And, you know, if you look at some pictures of it, on one hand, I think it actually looks kind of neat seeing this kind of self-contained water kit with a graphics card. On the other hand, if you look at just the design of the card of itself, it I don't say it borrows what a lot from what NVIDIA did with the 700 series or the Titan or the GTX 690, but you can tell that AMD spent a lot more time developing the look and style of the card than they had with really any of their cards in the past, right? I think that's all a credit to NVIDIA and their kind of, you know, push in that regard. And so the card by itself looks good. It has a nice black metal finish with, you know, silver metal finish to it with just the red for the fan and red for the logo on top.
Yeah, for $1,500 though, this is a premium part. It probably should be good looking, or it should be a monster performer. What's the TDP on those two chips that they went to water cooling?
It's 500 watts, right? And that's a that's a lot, and it kind of tells you why they had to go the route of water cooling. It's actually even a very interesting portion of this product release is based around that TDP. If you look at the card itself, it only has two 8-pin power connections. And for people that don't really know how that is supposed to work, PCI Express has a, you know, specifications for, you know, power delivery and power draw, and power supplies have to meet this and motherboards have to meet this, and all the products that draw power are supposed to meet these kind of PCIe specifications. The general rule of thumb has been you get 75 watts of power through the PCI Express bus itself, like through the card, through the connection to the motherboard. And then a 3-pin power connector gets you 75 watts of additional power, and an 8-pin power connector gets you 150 watts of additional power. So in theory, doing the math, you would only get 375 watts total power to this card through the two 8-pin connections and the PCI Express bus itself. But if the card has a TDP of 500 watts, how do you... how do you do that? Where are they making up that difference? And if you look at the second page of the article, it kind of really focuses on how they fix that, right? So they basically, you know, in the conversations we had, they said, you know, these specifications are just that. They're just kind of requirements on companies to make sure things are safe. But there's no reason that the cables that these high-end power supplies are building into their systems can't provide more power than what is being provided. And they're absolutely correct, right? These are, you know, if you look at power supply ratings, they're rated at, you know, up to 30 amps on single 12-volt rails.
You know,
60, 70, 80, 90 watts for the entire 12-volt configuration if you have single rail or multi-rail. The problem that AMD has kind of created by having this car with only 2 8-pin connectors is you now have to do a little bit more research on your power supply and make sure that it can be hooked up correctly and that you hook it up correctly when you're installing the card. Essentially, what has to happen now is each 8-pin connector has to be able to provide 28 amps of power to the card individually. If you have a single rail power supply, it's not really that big a deal as long as you can look at it and say 12 volt can provide, you know, 50 or more watts, you'll be fine. If you have a multi-rail power supply, which I think is still more popular today, then you have to get into things like, well, which rail is powering the processor, which rail is powering the motherboard, which rail is powering all the hard drives I have in my system or whatever. And you have to, like, if you have a modular PSU on the back, you're going to have to take care to look at which cables are actually attached to which rails of a power supply, which is something we've never really had to do before. They give you an example in the second picture on that page of our article that says, you know, sometimes on the back of a power supply, you'll have two connections that are, you know, both attached to, say, the fifth 12-volt rail. And each in that fifth 12-volt rail is rated at 30 amps. Well, that means if you're going to you have to dedicate that entire rail to one of the plugs going into the graphics card. So you kind of have to, you know, I'm going to use one of these available connections from the power supply, but I can't use the other one for anything else. Like, you can't plug in a secondary card. You can't, you know, attach a bunch of hard drives to it or something like that. So you need to kind of look out for that. And it's not really, it's not a deal breaker. It's not that big of a deal. People who are buying a $1,500 video card probably are comfortable looking up specifications of their power supply. There will be a sticker on it, or there'll be, you know, information on the company's website. I guess my biggest issue with it was, in my mind, I don't design power supplies or video cards for a living, but had they just added a third 8-pin power connector, that would have given them an additional 150 watts, which would have taken them to 525 watts, which then you wouldn't have had to worry about which rail you were connecting to, I don't think. So they didn't want to do that for some reason, and instead they kind of, you know, wanted to, I think it would have been, maybe system builders would have been concerned about having three power connections, but at the end of the day, you're still drawing the same amount of power you would through two connections or three connections. Nothing's changing physically. Mm-hmm. You know, electrically, it's still drawing the same amount of power. It's just a matter of how easy it is for the, you know, DIY person to understand and to actually construct. So little interesting there. But otherwise, you know, the card looks good and performs well. We benchmarked it compared to a pair of GTX 780 Ti cards running an SLI, and it was faster than those cards, right? Sometimes by a small margin, sometimes by a larger margin. And as I said earlier, at 4K, we're really talking about, that's where it kind of stretches its legs and kind of gets out into where you might need a $1,500 video card today. For example, in Battlefield 4, with this card, you're able to run over 45 frames per second at 4K at the ultra preset, right? So that's saying something, right? That's a lot of that. That gives you an idea of the power of this card. You are actually getting two Radeon R9 290X cards in a single package. It's a two-slot card, but obviously you have this water cooling portion of it that you have to deal with. It's not exactly, I hate to consider it a slim card because of that, but yeah, it can do that. So it's an interesting product power consumption wise. It's drawing, you know, it's going to draw that 500 watt of TDP. But again, if you're buying a $1,500 video card, I think we both agree that you're probably going to have a pretty good power supply, and or you're going to be willing to buy a pretty good power supply for that.
Right.
So, yeah, sound levels are good as well, which is a plus, right? The water cooling part helps with that a lot.
It's funny. We've got a Puget system in that was built for 4K with one of the Asus PQ321Q monitors that you have gently, I think, sworn that they will pry from your cold, dead fingers.
Very gentle.
As funny, right? So, you know, it's a $3,000 monitor. It looks stunning. Gaming on it when you can get 4K support looks stunning. And it should, because I think there's two RT90s in the box that we've got, right? So it's a tremendous amount of computing power inside of there. And it's funny, we're just starting to see the first signs of like a $700 60 hertz 4K, like 29, 27 inch desktop monitor. And, you know, it makes me wonder how long it's going to take for serious 4K flat panels, or excuse me, serious 4K power to come out of a sub-$1,000 GPU. Like, how long before we have a $300 GPU that can power a 4K monitor? And it's a non-trivial issue. You know, you're quadrupling the number of pixels from a 1080p monitor. And I keep looking at this monitor going like, you know, I get it. At some point, you know, the pixel density is so high that we can no longer register the additional points of light. But wow, this looks amazing. And holy crap, does it require a ridiculous amount of GPU power. But for anybody out there who's looking at a $1,500 GPU, it's like, you probably already spent, you know, $3,000 on a monitor to run it to.
Yeah.
Which is kind of terrifying.
I came away from the product, you know, The price is high. Like, there's no getting around that. It's about $100 more than buying a pair of GTX 780 Ti cards, and running them in SLI. You get better performance out of it. You get more memory per GPU, and you're only using up two slots on your motherboard. You know, which can be a benefit if you have a lot of other accessories you want to work with. It is. Right. Like $300 more than buying a pair of R9 290X cards, as well. So, you know, you are paying a $250 to $300 premium over just buying two of the cards by themselves. Mm-hmm. Even if you want to, you know, even if you stay inside the AMD ecosystem with that, and you know, there's something to be said for the additional design work, the water cooling, mm-hmm. the lower noise levels. Whether or not that would be worth $300. To somebody, you know, even if you consider yourself like you're going to spend a lot of money on a system and you know, you want to game it 4K or something like that, $200 or $300 may still, you might go, well, I could buy an extra SSD, or, you know, I could, you know, move up to that terabyte instead of the 500 gig SSD or something like that, and wouldn't take anything else out of your budget, right? So on one hand, it seems weird, like if you're spending $1,500 bucks on a video card, that somehow $300 would matter, but it very well could. So it's a really cool card. And obviously, do we wish this were somehow magically have come out for sale at $999 bucks? Of course. But this is kind of pretty much exactly where I expected it.
No, and that makes sense. I mean, part of it's this is kind of AMD's boutique response to NVIDIA's boutique card, the Titan. When I say boutique, I mean, you know, smaller runs, higher margins, you know, very sophisticated engineering and design, going for a lot of stuff that maybe they don't normally go for, like really, really quiet, you know, overcompensating on cooling. Mark T posted in the chat room, he goes, those two items, $300 graphics and 4K monitor, are in two different price points. Yeah, right now they are, but we're seeing the first $700 4K desktop monitors. Nobody's going to want to spend $1,000 for a GPU that's going to fuel that 4K monitor for gaming. And the truth is 4K, you know, as a desktop, if you can afford it, do it right now, especially if you get it on 60 hertz. I would do it with 30 hertz. If you can get a 60 hertz monitor, 4K gaming is really neat when you can actually get a game that has full support for it. Titanfall, right? They're working on a 4K support, but it's not in place yet. There's a bunch of games, you know, even from a couple of years ago that look fantastic in 4K. But, you know, part of what I think Ryan and I are really excited about is watching 4K drop, because a 4K, you know, 30-inch desktop is amazing. And I want to be able to afford that without, you know, starving my children or selling their kidneys. But hey, they've got two, right? Moving way to the other end of the price section, the AMD AM1 Athlon 5350 reviewed. Let us talk about affordable APU action from the AMD crew. Way different part.
Like a $59 processor as opposed to a $1,500 graphics card. Josh wrote this review up. This is actually a, it's kind of interesting, right? Because when we think of SoCs, which are system on a chip, it's a processor, it's your graphics, it's your IO, it's, you know, we tend to think of those as soldered down products, you know, not things that are replaceable and socketed parts. The AMD AM1 platform, which we reviewed with the Athlon 5350, is a socketed Kabini processor. So you're talking about super low cost processors, super low cost motherboards and platforms. And, you know, they're based on Jaguar cores. I think it's, this is a quad core Jaguar part. And then the motherboards are going to be almost exclusively mini ITX and micro ATX, just because those are the form factors that we're really targeting here. It looks like the Athlon 5350 is a 2 gigahertz part quad core with 128 GCN Radeon cores. So GPU frequency of 600 megahertz and 2 megs of cache. It does have support for 2 USB 3.0 ports, 8 USB 2.0, and 2 SATA 6 gigabit per second ports as well. And again, that's all on the chip itself. There's no chipset on the motherboard, right?
Okay.
And this is a 25 watt TDP part. So it's super low power consumption. It's meant for, I'd say it's really kind of, it was launched initially kind of in the emerging markets areas, you know, India, South America, Asia. But I think AMD, as they are, you know, trying to find any foothold they can in any kind of processor market they can. These are I think they're already starting to show up for sale at Amazon and Newegg with these parts. It's kind of interesting, you know. So now AMD has a part that starts at 25 watts like this, that is a user replaceable socketed part, and you can go up to 220 watts with the FX 9000 series of CPUs as well. It's pretty interesting stuff. It's kind of comparable to Bay Trail, right? You can think of it at a similar performance level. This is going to be maybe a little bit better performing on the CPU side, probably a little bit more significantly better performing on the GPU side. We actually had a Bay Trail platform in for Josh to compare with it, but we apparently killed it in transit, or FedEx killed it in transit or something, because he could never get it to actually post. The performance comparisons for that, we'll wait until I think Gigabyte sending us a replacement for that. But those, again, are platforms that you buy that are kind of pre-assembled, soldered down, heat sinks already on there, that type of thing. With this one, you buy the motherboard and you buy the processor, and the processor will come with the heat sink. So it's an interesting product to maybe think about for, we always talk about home theater PCs, NAS devices, multifunction computers, and you can look through the review and see all Josh's benchmarks, but something that Ken and I were playing around with today. Remember, we talked a couple of weeks ago about building a machine built around like the Intel Pentium G3220 or the Athlon X4 760K as kind of like these super low cost processors with a moderate mainstream graphics card, making a low cost gaming PC out of it. We did some tests with this, and this might still be an option for somebody who wants to build a super low cost budget gaming PC as well. Cause the motherboard that I got in actually has a full size PCI Express by 16 slot. The one that Josh got in only had a by one slot. So depends on what the market is for those. It's an interesting little platform. But I mean, and that's what it is. That's what you have to consider it. It's a platform. It's not necessarily a new processor. And I do wonder, I'm curious, maybe, you know, you can offer some thoughts on would you, or do you envision people wanting a user replaceable processor and a platform that's this cost, this power consumption, this performance level, I guess?
I think you and I and most of the people listening to this podcast have a difficulty envisioning the idea of buying a desktop part that's soldered to the motherboard. I don't know if that's me. I don't know if I'm projecting on you, but at least we want the illusion that we might upgrade the processor in the future and not just want to upgrade to the next generation processor that's available in 3 years. you know, I keep looking at this part and thinking like, oh, if it had support for ECC RAM, it would be the perfect FreeNAS processor. And I'm like, hey, I've been wanting to build a, you know, a router box with a VPN built in. And all of a sudden it's like, wow, for $100, you know, I got a decent, you know, 400 watt power supply I could drop in there. You know, another $50 for memory. I could have this unbelievable badass $200 router box, you know, to go along with all the other weird stuff I have hanging out in the basement of my house, keeping the bits flowing. You know, I also, it's funny, I've found my computing as of late is in one of two places. Either the highest end gaming performance I can get my grubby little paws on, you know, which for me is like a 770 and a Core i7 920 at home with like, you know, 8 or 16 gigabytes of RAM. And then, that 4K box we have at work, or it's, I've been spending a lot of time with all-in-one desktop PCs and laptops. And, you know, a 25-watt part in a desktop PC that still has decent GPU, you know, graphics performance is really compelling. And the truth is that's probably a huge sweet spot for the majority of buyers out there. You know, it's going to be interesting, right? You know, we still don't really have decent graphics performance in all-in-ones for the most part, not entirely, or in desktops, laptops, you know, like not entirely, but for the most part. You know, I just want to see, you know, I want an upgradable part, but, you know, I take things apart. I've used a car radiator for water cooling. I've overclocked, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I have joined the Ryan Shroud. You will pry the 4K monitors from, you know, my fingers, by whatever means you find necessary, but I'm not going to give it up willingly because it's just that nice to work on. So maybe, you know, most of us creating or listening to this podcast are probably sort of, you know, on the far side of the bell curve, not in the middle of it. So I don't know. I mean, is I want fast stuff. I want it to be upgradable. Even the inexpensive stuff I buy, I want to be upgradable. You know, also, when you think about that, the thermal, the TDP on that, it's like, where could I put this? I could put it in a desk drawer. I could put it behind, you know, it just... I don't know. It's interesting. Yep. Like this, the next unit of computing, you know, I just want, just put a second Ethernet port on it.
I can do
all sorts of cool stuff with it. Oh my goodness. Visa. I can never, you know, after 25 years, I should know which one is which. but they may have accepted AMD's FreeSync. VESA, you might know as the standards body that controls monitors. You probably think about it mostly when you're looking for VESA mounts on the back of HDTVs and desktop monitors. But apparently, they have accepted AMD's proposal for FreeSync. I'm quoting Scott here. Into an extension of the DisplayPort 1.2a standard, FreeSync is the standards-based answer to NVIDIA's G-Sync. Dun, dun, dun. A process for allowing the monitor to time itself according to its driving GPU. All right. Does this mean that AMD has flanked NVIDIA on the G-Sync, NVIDIA's G-Sync technology? Or does it mean we now have two competing standards that the majority of consumers will ignore? That sounded harsh even for me.
I think flanked is the right term for that, right? Because AMD has been mostly silent on the idea of what G-Sync is and the benefits of it and whether or not they would kind of introduce their own thing. And then at CES, they first kind of talked about what they dubbed FreeSync. It's kind of a jab at NVIDIA. This is still a rumor that it will be in DP 1.2a. But if it's true, I think it's obviously dependent completely on the timetable for implementation. Could undermine what G-Sync does. Now, there are other things we talked about last night, right? Well, we don't know any of the specifics about this. Maybe it caps the refresh rate at 60 hertz. Maybe it caps it at 100 so hertz, right? Or something like that. Maybe it's like it doesn't have the flexibility that you get with what NVIDIA is doing, right? Because NVIDIA kind of in their driver is willing and able to hand tune for each kind of display that comes out that supports G-Sync. So, you know, they'll be able to work with ASUS when that 25x14 monitor finally comes out and say, okay, we can comfortably go up to 144 with you or 135. So we'll make sure our driver knows that and react accordingly. Whereas the VESA standard will have to do one of two things. Depend on kind of an updated, the information that they send between display and graphics card. I can't remember what it is off the top of my head now. But, you know, additional communication between the display and the graphics card to kind of handshake on some of those settings. So if this is true, that's good news, right? Because the more displays that support this technology, the better. I think NVIDIA obviously doesn't want this to be true. They want to have an advantage on the display side. But the truth is it feels an awful lot like NVIDIA and their partners have either been dragging their feet or there have been delays and issues with getting these actual G-Sync monitors out. Because after the flurry of activity we saw the first week of January at CES, we really have no releases of products since. So if this pushes things forward on either front, either getting those actual G-Sync displays out or the first displays out that will have an alternative to G-Sync, I'm definitely for it.
Yeah, I don't know. I've also noticed that monitors don't seem to get updated as often as they used to. And there's the 4K thing. 4K is just so delightful and wonderful, and I'm just going to stop talking about it lest the entire audience just spasm and reject the entire podcast, because two of us singing the glories of 4K is probably at least one too many.
Yeah.
NVIDIA 337.50 driver and GeForce Experience 2.0 release. Scott wrote this up for PC Per. We knew that NVIDIA had an impending driver update providing DX11 performance improvements. Launched today, 337.50 still claims significant performance increases over the previous 335.23 version. What was the surprise is GeForce Experience 2.0. This version allows both Shadow Play and Game Stream to operate on notebooks. It also allows Shadow Play to record and apparently stream to Twitch, your Windows desktop, but not on notebooks. It also enables battery boost, which Scott's discussed previously. Are you excited about this? You know, it seems to be a cleaner interface, or am I just projecting desire on NVIDIA's drive that occasionally looks too complicated?
They've definitely improved the UI pretty dramatically. And what's interesting is they've taken Shadow Play, which launched as the ability to record game footage using the integrated kind of H.264 encoder on GeForce GPUs. And they've really kind of slowly but steadily expanded out the feature set that this technology really offers to the gamer, right? This is part of NVIDIA's kind of wide-ranging campaign of, hey, it's not just about frame rate. Frame rate is important, and performance, right, we're still going to offer it. But what about these other things that we can give you that differentiate us, right? So I think the ability to stream your desktop, you can now stream your entire desktop, so you can do game plus an overlay plus lower thirds plus whatever, is actually pretty interesting, because now you can use GeForce Experience with the Shadow Play technology to that's essentially all you need now to do your own kind of game streaming with voiceover and having your own picture-in-picture, you know, camera shot of your face, things like that going on. And it's actually pretty neat, right? We do that every once in a while here, and we have a whole host of complicated computers and cables and cameras and stuff set up to do it. For our purposes, I don't think that will change, but for just the average person that wants to do that at home, you know, you're starting to see, you know, think of what Xbox One and PlayStation 4 said they were going to offer with Twitch streaming and how easy that was going to be. And NVIDIA is attempting to bring that same mindset and feature set to the PC, which I think is worthwhile for sure. People take advantage of it.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Can't really add anything to that. Amazon takes on Apple TV, Roku, and Ouya with a $99 Fire TV streaming box. We posted our review of the Apple Fire TV on HD Nation earlier today. I think it's been on YouTube for hours. If you want to get a full demo of it, it's interesting, because, and I love the fact you noticed that they were taking on Ouya, because as far as I'm concerned, it's like a $40, $39.99 for the controller that you see there. If I were Ouya, I would be panicking right now, because Amazon has deep pockets, an incredible vendor base, and all they really care about is Amazon videos, which is really obvious from using this. The big kind of attraction to this, if you scroll up to the top picture, you'll see the voice search button on the remote control. Fantastic Bluetooth remote control. Go ahead and
go ahead and, you know, hide your Amazon Fire TV behind your television in the closet, in a desk drawer. The Bluetooth remote will get it. But the big thing is they really want you to use voice search. So you press the microphone button, you say what you're looking for, it pops up, and it's really cool until you realize three things. If it's on Amazon Prime, you got to dig to a second window to get to it. And if it's available for free or you already own it on any other channel or platform that's currently available as an app on Amazon Fire TV, it's not going to tell you about that, right? So it's a very, you know, it may be part of the early development phase. I doubt it. I think it's more because it's about, you know, bringing people and keeping them into the Amazon ecosystem. You know, it's a fantastic quad-core box. The graphics are good. I would be panicking right now if I was Ouya, because this, for $100 and $39 a controller with support up to 5 controllers, this is a really cool Android gaming box, by the way, that does a fantastic job streaming 1080p. By the way, although 5.1 audio isn't implemented yet, there is a Plex application you can install on this. There is, however, no Angry Birds. So technically, it may not be a legitimate platform, because the Heron Norton law of platform legitimacy states that no platform is real until it actually hosts its own version of Angry Birds, which the Roku 3 does. But the Amazon Fire TV does not yet. So I'm hoping for an Angry.
I have one here. I actually haven't hooked it up yet.
You should.
Yeah, I know. The voice search sounded the most interesting to me. What this remote really needs in the back of it is a keyboard, right? Like the what was the remote that did that first? The Boxy box.
There've been so many over there. Yeah, the Boxy.
It had just your normal remote on this side. On the back, it had a QWERTY style kind of like thumb use keyboard, mm-hmm. and that would kind of alleviate some of the input issues with searching for things if you can't use the voice search.
Yeah, and it's interesting. Like last week, I did a review of the smart keyboard from Logitech owns Harmony, which did their keyboard based universal remote. And I got to be honest with you, having a full size keyboard when you're trying to find, you know, season 7 of some program or a documentary is fantastic. You know, I don't think anybody's really done a great job with it. And I think Amazon being so focused on mass consumers, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean that in trying to make engineering processes and engineering decisions that make it easier for people to use their product. You know, the voice search just delete expletive worked. I wish it did more. I wish they had it. You know, I hope they adapt it for other applications over time. But it was an interesting experience, right? Because I use Amazon Prime pretty regularly because, you know, I'm a dedicated Netflix user and have been for years. And then when Viacom moved all of the Nickelodeon, the Nick Jr. cartoons over, well, they pulled them off of Netflix. They ended up on Amazon Prime. And then all of a sudden I got really intimate with the Amazon Prime interface. This is funny. I mean, the interface, I mean, you know, the Fire OS or whatever Android's calling it is essentially whatever Amazon's calling it is Amazon's flavor of Android. The tablet users are going to be very familiar with it. It's an interesting product. You know, if you're an Amazon, you know, video, Amazon Instant Video user, if you're an Amazon Prime user, it makes a lot of sense. You know, it's going to be interesting to see what kind of games they develop for it, because they're spending money to develop some really cool games. So I think it's got a lot of potential. It's supposed to be a tool for enabling the mass consumption of Amazon content, but I think it's got a really good kind of story there also, and the fact that it's a really badass Android-based gaming box. And there's some compelling titles on it already. I'm excited. You can watch the full review, get a full demonstration of the interface on HD Nation if you want to see that. They just posted today. It's interesting, dude. It's a really interesting box. And if you don't use Amazon Prime, or Amazon Instant Video, you really don't want this box unless you plan
going
to it.
Okay.
Well, yeah. You know what I mean? Like Apple, you know, the Apple TV, if you don't use Apple ecosystem, it still works. It's a great Netflix box. This one, it's funny, like, you can argue that Netflix or Hulu or Amazon Prime or Crackle or Crunchyroll, or, you know, we could go on listing online video services for days, our second class citizens on the Chromecast or on the Apple TV. But it's very distinctive right now. The speed and the finish and the slickness of the interface for the Amazon products on the Fire TV is a big step ahead of the way all the other apps seem like standard Google apps. So, or Google, you know, Android apps. It's interesting. It's going to be really interesting, I think, to see where this evolves. There's a lot of power for a set-top box. And that's actually really exciting for anybody who does want to pony up for, you know, $500 for a console and still wants to game with people on a big screen. It's got a lot of potential. What I don't know if it has a lot of potential is Thunderbolt networking, which was announced for Windows at NAB 2014. NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, which is mostly a lot of meetings with people in the broadcast industry, whether it's radio or television or cable or now the interwebs, talk about the things they need. The cool thing is the show floor at NAB, where you can see everything from, you know, multi-million dollar, you know, 1080p and 4K professional cameras, the kind of stuff you see at the Super Bowl on the sidelines, all the way down to inexpensive gear for podcasters. You know, it's no longer, you know, quote, also it was originally exclusive to Apple. So you can guess which industries were first adopters. Intel has focused their Thunderbolt announcements on the National Association of Broadcasters show this year. Thunderbolt networking will be available for Windows via a driver. This will allow any connection of Mac and Windows PCs to be paired together by a 10 gigabit network. It's Scott writing that up at PC Per. Of course, quote, this is not going to be something you can plug into a router. This is a point-to-point network for sharing files between two devices really fast. So, you know, it's like BitTorrent sync with a $50 cable at 10 gigabit point-to-point.
So it may be the cheapest 10 gigabit networking you can get. Right?
Well, is it really a network if it only has two nodes? Is that a net or is that a line?
probably.
You know, I think it has to be at least three intersecting things to be a network. I could be wrong. Hey, what's the story on the? I thought it was a consumer drive, but apparently Seagate's new 6 terabyte drive is an enterprise drive.
Yeah, I mean anybody could buy it. This isn't the first 6 terabyte drive we've seen, but it is interesting, as Alan pointed out last night. But this one, I think the first one we saw had hydrogen gas inside. Was it hydrogen? Nitrogen? Yeah. One of those.
Hydrogen? Helium. Helium, I bet.
Helium, thank you. It was a gas of some kind that, you know, helped maintain.
Gas choice makes a difference. You realize that there are just inert gases and there are volatile gases.
It didn't have the ones that catch on fire, maybe. Easily. It was basically the gas in there was meant to maintain, you know, tighter thresholds because the platters had to be closer together and all that stuff. This is actually using, I think that one used 6 platters. This is only using 4 platters, 4 1.2 terabyte platters on there, so they're further apart, more of your kind of standard design for a hard drive, obviously, except for, you know, they're just higher density platters,
right,
both SATA 3 and 12 gigabit per second SAS interfaces, 7200 RPM drives with 128 megs of cache on them. They're rated at 216 megabytes per second for sequential transfer speeds, which is pretty good. And latency levels of about 4.16 milliseconds, which is good for a hard drive. Obviously, it's not in the SSD realm, but it's obviously pretty good for a hard drive. MSRP expected to be $650, though.
Well, this is pretty high-end stuff. I mean, this is I think it's, you know, you're talking about 5 disks and incredible density on there. It's interesting. There's an article up on Extreme Tech that has a pretty good summary. Helium is thinner than air, meaning the platters meet less resistance, so they generate less heat and consume less power.
Gotcha.
And that was the Western Digital Ultrastar HE6. Western Digital, of course, owns Hitachi, and they're doing those, or the company formerly known as Hitachi, which was formerly known as IBM. But that's a long and complicated discussion about acquisition of names. But I'm just excited. Anytime we see a capacity jump in hard drives, I just get excited. And I'm ready for a good $200 6-terabyte hard drive. Because, you know, smaller zeros and ones make for even more incredible need to back up your gear on multiple drives.
Yep.
But think about that, dude. You could have 6, 4, 8, 48. Mm-hmm. Wow. I could do almost like 30 terabytes in my NAS, 35, 37 terabytes in my NAS. I like that thought. My slow march to petabytes.
You're getting there. You're getting there.
We have viewer questions, but because he loves you more than I do, Ryan is giving away video cards.
Yeah. If you go over to, it's actually on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/PCPer. And there's also a news post at PCPer.com. We have a short little video to watch. You can win. We're giving away a Galaxy GeForce GTX 750 Ti overclocked edition and a GTX 750 overclocked edition as well. And all you have to do is be a subscriber and you're commenting and that kind of stuff. And you'll be entered in the contest. So if you want to win one of those, find that video, comment, and subscribe accordingly, and you can win one of those two graphics cards from our friends over at Galaxy. So, but now we can dive into our questions if you want to.
Where did they go? Where did they go? All of the questions. But yes, Ryan at PC Pro love you more than I do because they give away graphics cards. Thank you, Galaxy. Got an email about R9 price cuts. By the way, if you want to email us, it's twitch@twit.tv. And you have mentioned on previous shows how the crypto coin, Litecoin, Dogecoin, Bitcoin mining has affected the GPU market. Get ready for extremely cheap cards to hit the market that are only a few months old. Long story short is that specialized ASICs have made GPU mining obsolete. The result is that I'm trying to sell two Sapphire Tri-X 9 280X cards, and I'm not even getting offers at a $250 asking price. Excellent, which means I can now afford to upgrade my card. AMD cards about to get hit real hard in the retail market, but savvy buyers are going to be able to get great cards at a significant bargain. And while I feel great sympathy for the crypto coin miners that are getting hammered in the GPU market, I am excited for GPUs to sort of normalize their prices back again as scarcity is reduced. It's kind of amazing the ingenuity that's going into the devices to do crypto coin mining, you know, Litecoin, Dogecoin, Bitcoin, Dogcoin, Ryan coin, Patrick coin, PC per coin, Texilla coin, like whatever the cryptocurrency of the minute is. Because, you know, we're starting to see people using Raspberry Pi boards to control these inexpensive dedicated ASICs. I also think it's a testament to how fast the IC market can move when it really wants to make money or just really wants to open up a new place to do fab work that isn't necessarily at the bleeding edge of process design. It's interesting. And I'm just really happy at the idea that GPU prices are going to go down. And if this hurts AMD, I'm really, really sorry.
I mean, that was always the fear, right? Right. That was always the fear that all these cars that are selling for really high prices now, it didn't benefit AMD at the time. Mm-hmm. It benefited them in that they were making their normal profit margin. It more benefited Newegg and Amazon, anybody that was actually selling the products directly. Right. But now if some of the stuff, we have a tidal wave of R9 280 and R9 290 cards coming back into the market, it's definitely going to lower prices on anything that's available. And it's going to keep whatever AMD has been producing, you know, for new product on the shelf quite a bit longer. So right. We'll see. It's weird.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, Bitcoins are down to $400 a piece. You know, the IRS has ruled that it's property and not currency. And yeah, I just posted a link, the 11, GH/S.
Giga hashes.
I can never remember. Thank you.
Giga hashes per second.
Yeah. I've heard that before and it just will not stick. Gigahash per second, Hex Fury is the latest low power ASIC Bitcoin miners. You know, and it's funny it's just, there's this entire subculture, hardware subculture around, you know, renting server time and building these incredible devices. You know, there's been some really amazing hardware hacks put together for this, but yeah, it's just,
they say this little device costs $265.
Yeah.
And it's going to make $15 a month.
Yeah.
On current difficulty, right. $12 a month on next difficulty. Yeah.
You know, but so you just wait for the next cryptocurrency to come out and throw it at that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be interesting, especially as we wait for people to upgrade to close the Heartbleed hole. Which, by the way, if you don't know about it, do some research on that and keep an eye on your passports. Excuse me, your passwords. Heartbleed is just so ugly. Maybe I'll talk about that in a second. But first, we're going to get an email from Kevin about changing upgrade cycles. Says, I've been a viewer of the show for quite a while now and really enjoy it. So thanks. Thanks for watching and listening, Kevin. This is my question. For a while, I've been in about a 4-year hardware refresh cycle where the only thing I'll replace afterwards is the video card, maybe add some RAM. This hasn't been working out so well for me lately, as I often play games that are mostly CPU bound, Civilization, Football Manager, etc., and I'm at the end of my 4-year cycle. I've been thinking I should shift from buying more expensive parts every 4 years to making smaller, approximately Canadian $300 CPU and motherboard purchases every year or two. I'm thinking that in this situation, it may make more sense to go the AMD route, but it's hard to find recommendations for AMD parts these days. Does it really make sense in this case to go with AMD? And if so, what budget, which parts would it make sense to buy? You know, if you're primarily CPU bound, I get the idea where you want to upgrade your hardware and get the boost of performance. Especially because the games you're talking about aren't really GPU burners in terms of you know, what gets taxed on your system. My thought is that if you upgrade every year or two, you know, even at $300, you may be profoundly underwhelmed by the performance you get, the performance improvement you get. You know, I still think around, for me personally, right, and I also still believe in defragging, which I'm still getting beat up for. Windows 7 did not fix drive fragmentation issues. It just improved them. But, you know, 3 years... You know, a CPU jump usually makes my hair go back. And what's been really interesting in the last few years is also the power consumption reduction in the last few years, especially on the Intel side, where you're looking at these ridiculously powerful parts that have ridiculously low power consumption compared to what a, you know, Core i7 4 years ago?
Yeah.
Was sucking down huge amounts of electricity. Compared to what it's available now, you know, I don't think you're going to, you know, lower your electrical bill considerably, but it's something to think about in terms of just, you know, putting less heat in your house when it's hot, or just, you know, consume less power. You know,
I don't know what
every year is expensive.
It's interesting because he's saying essentially that. Right. Every 4 years, he builds a new system, I think. Whereas in the time between that, he'll only kind of like upgrade the video card and maybe add some RAM. the issue that I think he wants to maybe say, can I maybe change that in a certain way so that I'll be able to upgrade the processor in those intermediate steps? And the problem is processor performance, as you're saying, is going up much less quickly than GPU right. performance. So adding $300 to your processor won't be nearly as effective in improving performance relative to the previous processor as $300 mm-hmm. for a video card every 2 years would relative to graphics card performance. So I don't really think going Intel or AMD in that direction is really going to change anything. I don't have any reason to believe that, you know, I mean, I know that the next Intel processor is going to be on a different socket, but I don't know what's going to be on beyond that, right? I don't know if you're going to have more socket and motherboard stability on Intel or AMD moving forward. I really don't, because AMD's processor right. roadmap is in flux as they try to ramp up performance just on IPC and CPU performance, right? So I don't think either direction is really going to be a better solution there. Your kind of best bet, if you're coming up, as he says, on that four-year cycle, is to maybe invest in as much in a high-end processor as you can now, mm-hmm. and ride that out for that four-year cycle, right? So that would be, going with a high-end Haswell part, like a 4770K, and, building it, getting a motherboard that's going to allow you to overclock it, another gigahertz or something like that. And that will help stretch out that processor investment over that four-year period. I think Haswell E will be out sooner rather than later. And that might be something with, six or eight cores. I think Intel said that would be 8-core and it'll be out in this half of the year. So that will give you more runway with the processor. And then you can still, buy maybe just a modest graphics card now and then save that $300 and kind of invest it in that next two-year cycle that you normally would. But I don't think either platform, AMD or Intel, is really going to permit more flexibility down the road than the other one, at least.
Just trying to think of an easier way to do it. No, it's not bad news. It's just, I guess just want everything to leap and bound forward at high speed. The truth is, it is getting faster, faster. wait with bated breath. Don't bait it too hard. It's funny. I posted a quick link in the chat room. It's up in the notes there. CNET has a nice list. They went to like the top 100 sites on Alexa. Don't get me started about Alexa. And asked them which ones had actually patched the heart bleed bug. And I want to mention that it's one of the nastiest security flaws, I think, ever in terms of what it is exposing. And of course, because I'm an idiot, I closed the link as I started talking. But there's news on this everywhere, from the major news networks down to serious hardcore security sites. If you haven't heard of Heartbleed, it's essentially a giant ass hole. Security hole that impacts pretty much everybody you go to on the internet. OpenSSL, which is the standard used by half the planet. And I tweeted about this at Patrick Norton a couple days ago. But essentially, OpenSSL has been exposed, potentially revealing password information and hat size and everything else on the planet. But they started going through it. It's been amazing to watch the response of major people on the internet. Amazon, for example, went nuts because they had to just do huge amounts to work to secure everybody's data again. But Google, Facebook, YouTube, Yahoo, Amazon, Wikipedia, LinkedIn, eBay, Twitter. In some cases, like LinkedIn, eBay, and Twitter were not vulnerable because they didn't use this particular implementation of SSL. Bing, Pinterest, Blogspot, Instagram, Tumblr, ESPN, go.com, Reddit, Netflix, Yelp. These are all GoDaddy, Etsy. You know what I mean? These are big names. Vimeo, Flickr. Certainly, everybody listening is on at least one, if not multiple, of these. And there's a whole bunch of places: Blogger, Dropbox, Publishers Clearinghouse. They're awaiting a response from them. But you get the idea, right? There's just a huge number of websites that were exposed, that have been exposed for some periods of time. So what you want to do is to change your password after you make sure that the website in question has patched the vulnerability. And most
you know, most people or most websites are being pretty open about that one. But it's one thing, we're a hardware podcast, but this is big enough that I want to make sure everybody knows about it and pays attention to it and updates their passwords, which is probably what I'll be doing for the rest of the evening because I've been working over this in the last couple of days.
It's a pain in the butt.
This is a good place for having a password manager. Where did it go? Knox Harrington talks about it. PC Guy 8088 talks about the chat room. LastPass has done a really good job of implementing a security check where they're basically looking and telling you which passwords need to be changed. So this is, if you haven't been running a password manager, this might be a really good time to start simply because, you know, in the case of LastPass, they're trying to help keep you secure above and beyond simple password management. They're basically helping you manage and reminding you to update the passwords that need to be updated to deal with the massive hole inside of OpenSSL, which is patchable, and the internet will get better and we'll all be safe. But yeah, this is, you know, if you don't know what OpenSSL is and what it does, just search for Heartbleed, OpenSSL on Google News or Tech Meme, and then, you know, try to restrain liquid coming from all of your orifices simultaneously as you fear and panic. For the most part, though, statistically, you're safe. but it's kind of like, wait a minute, they left all of the keys unlocked outside of the house. Well, at least there wasn't a big sign pointing at them. At Ryan Shroud, 4K 60 hertz monitors on existing hardware tweets at LeeOps 1984. Is it even possible, or will I need to buy a new GPU? Because apparently I just can't walk away from 4K in this podcast today.
I mean, it's possible. You can definitely do it. It's, but you need high end of hardware today, right? If you have a 780 Ti or you have a 290X, you'll be able to run it. You won't be able to run it at max image quality settings and try to get anything close to 60 frames per second on most modern games. But you'll be able to do it for sure. There's no technological reason why you can't. The issue will be is, well, I want to run Crysis 3 at max settings. You're going to need one of those 295X2 cards and maybe more than that for that particular game. But if you're going to play, you know, I don't know, Battlefield 4, obviously we talked about you could do that at, you know, 50, 60 frames per second. If you're going to play something like Grid 2 or Bioshock Infinite, you're going to be able to play those at playable frame rates with a single GPU at 4K. Just be prepared to kind of play with the quality settings. But yeah, it's totally possible today. Just not at max settings.
There you have it. At Raggy 34 says, at Ryan Shroud, at Patrick Norton, what budget CPU to buy for under $100? I've been playing around with an NVIDIA 630, which is pretty impressive and costs approximately nothing in GPU dollars, which is to say about 68 bucks. Very low power consumption, great card for a home theater box where you need low power and don't need a lot of gaming performance. Man, I got to say, if you're going to spend $100 on a GPU, if you can find another 50 bucks, buy a 750 Ti, a GTX 750 Ti. Man, that part kicks ass for the money. Well, I'm just so used to us getting GPU questions, I went straight there. Well, those are some great GPUs. My GPU advice is to spend an extra $50. CPUs. Well, I'm just totally unprepared to answer that. Just get a Core i5.
I will tell you, I think we talked about it last week. You weren't here. There's an article we posted on PCPro.com called Building a Gaming PC for 1080p for under $550. And we used two processors that I would not have normally used. The Athlon X4 760K is $80, and the Intel Pentium G3220 is $65. And that $65 Pentium part, it's only a dual core two thread part, but it is Haswell. And it runs at a 3 gigahertz or something like that. And we did gaming testing with it with an R9 270. And it actually did very, very, very well, I think, comparatively. So, you know, that the benefit of getting something like the Pentium G3220 for $65 is that you can use, it's the same socket that the Core i7-4770K uses. So that gives you room to upgrade if you want to, right? So you can even that low-cost ASUS H81ME motherboard that's $60 listed there is a is compatible with the higher end processors. So you could buy the $65 processor and you can, I think you'll be pretty happy with it if you're using it for gaming purposes. But then you can, you have options to go forward, right? You can get a quad core part with 4 threads. You can get a quad core part with 8 threads, see performance improvements there. So I was surprised that those two parts, like those are things I just bought off Amazon because I had lots of people yelling at me on the internet saying that these are the parts that people are using if they're building budget machines. You know, I'm used to dealing with 4770K, 4670K. Those are not budget parts by the standards of many people. So we bought these parts and tested them, and I was pleasantly surprised by the gaming experience they offered. I will say that, as Ken pointed out on our podcast last night, that you, when you're doing other things like in the desktop, you can still tell a difference. Like if you're using the Pentium part versus the Core i7 part, you're going to tell a difference. And this is, you know, when you get back into a dual core, 2-thread machine, that's when you have to start being careful about closing down background applications, not leaving, you know, browser windows open, not leaving, you know, not having security scans running in the background or something like that, because now you don't have the headroom to make up for that with a quad core 8-thread processor or something like that. So that's the only thing to look out for when you get into those sub $100 parts.
And it's funny, there's a lot of $500 builds floating around the internet right now as part of, like, you know, whether it's for Titanfall or just beating on the Xbox One. And it's pretty impressive the performance you're getting. Like, you know, if you can find an extra $50 or $150, that, you know, as I mentioned, this is a GPU, but the GTX 750 Ti, there are advantages to be had in terms of a Core i3 or some of the later AMD APUs. You know, we built what I think ended up being a $450 gaming machine for one of our editors around an AMD part, and it's fantastic. Can you tell the difference between that and a, you know, a Core i7 with 16 gigabytes of RAM? Yeah, when you're doing a lot, but if you're, you know, browsing onesie twosie and keeping your gaming relatively restrained on a 1080p monitor, it's pretty amazing.
I see some people in the chat room complaining that the word Pentium still exists. It's a Haswell architecture CPU. It's just they disabled it until it's down to 2 cores and they can sell it for cheaper. So
Intel. And on those words, I think it's a good time to just draw this podcast to a close. At Ryan Schrout, at Patrick Norton on Twitter, PCPro.com is where you can find Ryan's latest reviews. I suspect he may be benchmarking something right now in the background. Can you reveal any information to us?
Are there any secrets? What I was doing today and what I'll probably be doing tomorrow is testing. NVIDIA released a new driver, the 337.5 driver, that supposedly added a lot of performance improvements for DX11 gaming as kind of their answer to Mantle. We're doing some testing on that to verify, you know, which games see the benefits and in which instances. And it's very complex. It's some games will see benefits at 1920, but not at 25x14. I'm sorry, 19x10. I think I said 19x20. 19x10 versus 25x14. Some of them will see it at both. Some of them will see it at neither. So it's kind of an interesting long testing process to kind of find and locate these different issues, but interesting stuff for sure.
You can find me at AC Nation, at Techzilla, man, it's been a lot of fun, both in terms of testing. Oh my goodness, the new HDTVs are coming out. We're doing those on AC Nation. Robert Harrod's benchmarking those, and the new Linksys router we showed off at CES. We looked.
I can't tell if it's pretty or ugly.
There was a giant one. Yes, it is like a Cylon. It is. I'm just very excited because I get excited about routers. I'm kind of crazy that way. It's going to be an interesting one. It is a big, burly, badass attempt to be the king of all routers. And I may have to buy a router to test against it because I'm not sure I own a badass enough router to benchmark against this. Feel free to start up in the chat room to tell me why I should be building a router on a PC at any moment. I can sense that coming, but we've got that coming up. We're going to be talking about 4K gaming because we can't walk away from 4K gaming, apparently. And it's funny. Benchmarking on Titanfall has been really amusing because Titanfall is frame locked to your monitor.
Yep.
You know, so you start looking at like how many features can I turn on with a given GPU? It's an interesting process. But we also, you know, we got a couple of relatively inexpensive GPUs in, and we're looking at some low cost builds because we can, because Ryan inspired us, Ryan and the crew at PC Purr. And by the way, as PC Purr has been hammering on for the last few weeks, holy crap, our SSD is getting cheap.
Yep.
It is a good time to be buying storage hardware. And with that bright, yep, cheerful note, I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch. Oh, my goodness. What a day.
Indeed.
All right.
Does LastPass, if you use LastPass, which I do not, how does it work with like your mobile devices, your tablets and phones and stuff?
If you pay
interesting.
If you pay $12 a year, you can install the app, but you can't, like, you know, you have to copy and paste the password into your apps.
Okay.
But you can, but it does have a browser in the LastPass app where you can, where it will autofill things. So if you want to
use their browser.
But you have to use their browser. Which kind of sucks. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
That's on iOS anyway. I don't know about Android. Android lets you overlay onto apps now, according to Panky. But.
Huh.
Yeah, for iOS, I mean, I do that. I do the copy and paste into apps and stuff. Once you're signed into the app, though, you usually don't have to keep signing in, but.
Right. Yeah, take a look at 1Password. Take a look at LastPass. I don't know. It's at this point, the password situation is getting so nuts. I think it's just a really good idea. But, you know, if you use a lot of apps across mobile and desktop environments, you might want to pay really close attention to which one you choose based on that.
Yeah.
Hold on. There's one more I'm missing.
Yeah, my LastPass is kind of a mess.
Why can I never remember KeePass's name? Yeah. Yeah, pretty much everybody knows either running KeePass or LastPass with the occasional 1Password fan. But KeePass and LastPass seem to have the majority of the mind share in the password universe. Mm. So. Mm. What do we like for title, dude?
I'm going to look through these notes. I don't know, something about $1,500 video cards.
I was gonna say gaming from 15 to 15 gaming parts from 15 from 50 to 50 $1,500.
Yeah. Oh, my Wisconsin guy's in the chat room again. Hi, Y guy. Yeah, the other guy. There is a puppy picture in there.
Oh, yeah. How could I have forgotten?
It's a funny one. My wife sent this one to me yesterday.
All right.
It's two pictures.
I'm getting it. Okay. You ready for it? You ready for the puppy pick? Boom. There's your puppy picks.
So the top was like the first couple of days we had them, and that's the same bed that they're in the bottom picture, which was yesterday or the day before.
Wow.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, they're quite a bit larger. Oh.
Growing puppies.
Puppies.
How much was that AMD CPU?
$59, $60. You can call whatever you want.
Has anyone used like LastPass, KeyPass, and 1Password to be able to make a decision about which one is better? Because LastPass,
sure, somebody.
LastPass is great, but it certainly gets hairy after a while. Like, I've got, mine's all messed up. I just suck at managing it, but when it creates new passwords, it saves it. You can't control the title of it until you go find it again, and you have to find the generic title for, like, generated password 4, and then edit it and change it, at least on iOS. And I don't do that sometimes, so then I've got all these generated random passwords. I don't know which is which. It's just terrible.
I'm looking for... here we go. I'm having one of those moments where Lifehacker is, of course, giving me all the interesting stuff, but not the actual article I'm looking for. Man, I know a couple people have worked with them all, but I can't, of course, find the article. I'll look for that, Josh. My apologies.
No, it's okay. I mean, I know Steve Gibson reviewed LastPass, and I know he likes it. I know a lot of people like LastPass, but, I mean, there's, you know.
LastPass does seem to be the leader in a lot of ways, unless you want open source, you know, in which case your option is kind of KeyPass.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then there's just, you know, iOS and password managers, I think, is a world-class pain in the ass.
It is.
Let me finish the titles before I get completely distracted. Sorry. And fall right down the internet hole. The internet swallowed my brain.
I'd like to try 1Password, but it doesn't cost like $30. I don't know. It's more money. I know it costs more, but I want to know for sure that, yes, this is much better and it's worth it. Anyway.
Huh. There were a lot of Wisconsin fans at that game. Why, guy? It's always interesting because when you have four teams at the Final Four. Kentucky's colors are blue and white. Florida's colors are blue and orange. UConn's navy blue, I guess. Wisconsin clearly red. It's from a distance, it's hard to tell, like, the blues apart, who they're actually rooting for, that type of thing. Could always see the Wisconsin people.
Wow.
Could always see the Wisconsin people.
All right.
They were nice people, though.
There we go. Sorry. Reduced my headroom a little bit. Wow, the loop on the video today is incredibly slow. In 3, 2, 1.